Hello, and welcome to David's Book Talk. And today we have a very special guest. He's an author that has written a book called Spycatcher, and it's by Matthew Dunn. It is a terrific, terrific spy thriller, and is published by William Morrow, and he's here to join us now. Hello.
David, hi. Thanks for having me on your show.
I love your accent. It's great. Where exactly are you in Britain?
I'm in the South Britain, actually, overlooking the English Channel, so just overlooking the sea. We're having a rather typically wet day right now, but it's still very picturesque.
Right, and we're having a particularly sunny day. We've had wet weather all week, and this is our first really bright, sunny day. I'm looking right up in the sun here.
All right, yeah. Well, usually for English summers, rain is normally what happens, but so today it's true to form, but for actually most of the summer, we've had pretty good weather.
Right. Let's talk about Spycatcher. Now, you know, I picked up this book, you know, and they asked me to read it and maybe possibly interview you, and when I heard you were a member of MI6, I was instantly intrigued. You know, I found this book really, really readable. I mean, it's really easy to read and just really a terrific novel.
Oh, thank you, thank you.
I was amazed at how much I was enjoying it going into it. I don't know what I expected. Now, there's so many books that come out today, and you want to like every one of them, but unfortunately, some of them you just can't get into. But this one is so engrossing.
Well, it's interesting, yeah, because I mean, I didn't write it with a particular audience in mind. I wrote it just as I wanted to write it, but it's interesting in terms of seeing the reviews and the feedback that's coming back as a result of publication, and it seems to be reaching a very wide, diverse audience, male, female, young and old, and that is, you know, I think for any writer that is great.
Wait, as you're writing the book, you don't think about your audience at all then? You're just writing what you know and what you like to write. Is that basically it?
Well, certainly from my perspective, yes. Obviously, I'm a first-time writer, so you approach, or one approaches the whole process with perhaps a degree of naivety. So I wrote the story that I wanted to tell, and I wrote it in the way that I wanted to tell it.
Well, how is it when being a first-time writer? I mean, how do you do it? I mean, I've always wondered that. I mean, how people write a book when they've never written a book before. I mean, was it difficult? Was it more difficult than you thought it would be?
No, for me. I mean, I think I've always, I know since childhood that I've always wanted to write. If anything, when I was at school, my favorite school lesson was creative writing. So it's always been in my blood.
I mean, you have some major talent. You really do. I mean, I can see you becoming as big as Lee Child, who actually has a blurb on the front of your book.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, again, it's very interesting. You speak about being a sort of first-time writer and what do you know? And the answer is you know nothing. You just write the book and then hope it does well. And, of course, you know, a lot of writers write novels that don't make it, and some, you know, write that do. And thankfully, I was in the latter category. But I wrote a story that I wanted to tell. I think that in terms of how I approach that that story, my background to some extent does help, because I was a field operative for MI6.
Right.
And a field operative means that you are somebody who's operating at the very sharp end of espionage. You are the person who's out there gathering the intelligence.
Was your life in danger a lot?
Well, all the time. I mean, it's...
How do you live like that? I mean, how do you get up in the morning knowing that you may not survive the day? How do you do that?
Well, I mean, I was in my 20s when I was doing it, and there wasn't... I was constantly aware of the danger, but at no point was I particularly fearful of it. I'm now in my early 40s, and when I look back at that world and you know, what I used to do, I think now that I do pause for thought a little bit, and I do look and wonder about what I used to do. But in those days, it was straight into the operations, straight into the missions, and to a large extent, I was taking on another role, the role of the identity that I was using for a particular mission, and I never ever felt feel that.
Do you, as you get older, did you become more fearful?
Well, certainly not when I was in there. I mean, I left MI6 10 years ago.
Okay, so you were in there for how long?
I was in there for, well, just under 6 years, although I've been in close contact with them ever since, as you may imagine.
Right.
So, you know, that contact has been probably over about a 15-year period. But my circumstances now are very different. I'm a single father. I have two young children to look after. So I think that what I did in those days would be very incompatible with what I do or the responsibilities that I have now. And as a result of that responsibility or different responsibility that I have now, I think I'm probably more attuned, more aware to the consequences of if something went wrong, you know, the implications of that for my family setup. But again, in those days, no, it was you know, straight into the missions without any fear whatsoever.
Now, Will Cochran, who is the main character in your book, is he going to be like what you went? I mean, are we going to find out what you went through him? Well, of course, with not the same names and everything, but I mean, is that the plan to do that?
Yeah, I mean, he's. I don't retreat from this question. He is derived, inspired by the man that I used to be, and I do stress used to be. And if anything, he was the hardest character for me to write, at least in terms of his decision making and emotions. And it took me a while to sort of work out why, and ultimately I realized that actually it's because I was writing about myself, but not writing about myself now, writing about myself as I was then. You know, that is the inspiration for the character, and in terms of what I'm going to do in terms of future books, I've already written book two, I'm halfway through writing book three.
Wow.
They're all featuring Will Cochran, and certainly my intention is to take this as far as it can go. So that could be 10, 15, 20 novels easily. There's a lot about the character that I want to explain over the course of various novels. In my view, he's quite a complex character.
That's very exciting because, I mean, I love your writing already. And, I mean, to think of two more books, I mean, that excites me a lot. I mean, just thinking about being able to read the way you write, I love the way you write. I mean, isn't that why we read authors? Because we love the way they write?
Yeah, I think so. And again, it wasn't, you know, when I wrote, I didn't write with a deliberate style or writing for a deliberate segment of the market. It was I just wanted to say it as I wanted. Thankfully, it's worked out. But as many authors say, particularly in the spy or the thriller genre, you know, it's as much about the journey as it is about the end result. And I think, thankfully, it seems that that's worked out very well with Spycatcher.
I mean, I think of like Robert Ludlum, who wrote spy novels, but his books were so huge, and there were so many characters and so many things to remember. And not that I'm knocking, a lot of people like Robert Ludlum. I you know, I find that the simple works best for me. I don't want too many. I don't want to have to remember so many different characters. You know, it can be very difficult, especially as you get older, to remember all these characters. But that's what makes your book so wonderful. It's so easy to remember the characters. I mean, we instantly can remember them from before and what they've been through. I mean, that's what I like about this. The simple works best for this.
What one device that I used, which was very deliberate, was that I wanted, even though the book is written in the third person, I wanted the readers to be constantly by Will Cochran's side. And the reason for that is that I wanted people to understand what it can be like in the field, the fact that you're on your own, that you have to make decisions on your own, typically.
Sometimes very quick decisions, too.
Very rapid decisions, and sometimes there may be the wrong decisions, but nevertheless, you have to make a decision. So that intensity, that isolation, was what I wanted to capture in terms of writing it. And of course, as a field operative, you're not surrounded by a cast of 30 or 40 different characters. It will be a small group of people, you know, in terms of the people that you're interacting with. And so that was very deliberate, and I didn't want to, certainly in the first novel, I didn't want to write it in a way that suddenly there was a cut scene to a different situation elsewhere with different characters. What I wanted to do was write it in a way that the readers have exactly the same amount of information that the central character, Will Cochrane, has, because I think that is an accurate portrayal of how it can be in the field, that this is the only information you have. You can't, halfway through an operation, a mission, call through to headquarters and say, look, what do I do next, or what am I missing? Can you give me a bit more information? Yeah. In real life, that doesn't happen for security reasons. You can't do that. So that's the style, that's the angle that I took in terms of writing it.
Now, I know. I remember there was a British series, I think, called MI5 or something. What is the difference between, pardon my ignorance here, but I don't know the difference between MI5 and MI6, and I mean, the CIA is like, our CIA is like the equivalent to MI6? I mean, how does that all work?
Exactly so. So MI6, correctly called the Secret Intelligence Service, is... its remit is to gather intelligence from overseas in exactly the same way that the CIA is tasked. MI5 is concerned with defensive operations, counter-terrorism within the UK, counter-espionage. In the old days, MI5 was concerned about Soviet penetration of the UK. Before that, Germany, Nazis, etc. So it's a defensive operation. Its remit now has broadened out to major organized crime, counter-narcotics, etc. So if anything, MI5 is more equivalent to the FBI. MI6 is directly equivalent to the CIA.
Oh, interesting. I never knew that before. Now, you said you were with them for 6 years. Could you have a relationship with somebody? I mean, were you able to, or was it... I mean, you obviously had a lot of secrets, and you couldn't reveal them to anybody you become involved with. But did you have a wife at the time, or did that happen after this was all over?
No, it happened. Well, in fact, if anything, it was the reason I left, was that I decided to get married and wanted to start a family. And during my time in MI6, it was a very intense, relentless period of my life. I was traveling approximately 70 to 80% of the time, and the missions were constant. They were back to back. So I felt that it would be incompatible to carry on that type of lifestyle with my ambition to start a family. So that was a reason. That said, there are MI6 officers who are married, who have families, and you know, other relationships. So it's not incompatible. It was just down to my particular circumstances and the specific operations that I was working on.
Right. So why did you leave? I mean, was it just time? Were you just exhausted from doing it?
No. As I say, the reason was purely down to desire to get married and start a family.
Okay. So it was that.
And you know, traveling 70-80% of the time, and the things that I had to do, it wouldn't have been probably the best start to a marriage.
Oh, no, definitely not. During this 6-year period, I mean, how many hours a day were you working? Were you constantly on alert for? I mean, did you have to? What was your life like?
It was 24/7. I mean, you're never off duty. That doesn't mean that you are always working.
You have to sleep and eat.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, but mentally, you are always on duty. You're operating in the secret world. So when I wasn't overseas on missions, at the time I lived in London, that was my home. So I would do what everyone else would do in London, and that's you know, go to restaurants or cafes or bars, go to the theatre, cinema, you know, do normal things. But even in doing so, I never felt connected to the people around me. I always felt that I was an outsider, because that's the mindset that you have. You're operating in the secret world, and the secret world is all around you. It can be as much London as it can be Budapest or Washington or wherever. So it's you are constantly aware of what you're doing, and also constantly aware of the threat to you, because as an operative, you know, when you're off duty, there are threats to you as much as when you're on duty. So yes, of course, you know, we're human beings. We eat, sleep, we do all of the things that others do. But certainly when you're operating, it can be very intense. It can be that you're managing to grab an hour, 2 hours sleep a night, if you can get that. It can be sometimes a little bit more than that, but certainly it can be a very exhausting experience.
Wow, I just wonder how you get through something like that. I mean, 6 years of that, I can't even imagine that. I mean, we here in America complain when we have to work 8 hours a day. You were working 24. I mean, people wouldn't even know what to do. I don't know how it would even function working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
It's the starting point to it is obviously why do you join the organization, and you don't join it for money because it's a government position ultimately, however it's wrapped up.
Well, what's the thrill of it? Just having a lot of secrets?
I don't think that's the thrill of it. I think the thrill of it largely is to do with the, and I'm certain this is probably true of the CIA, that in joining MI6, MI6 recruits the brightest and the best of the country. You know, there are bright and, you know, good people who operate in other jobs, but certainly the people that MI6 targets, you know, they are the brightest people they can possibly get. But not just intellect, it's also about a certain mindset. And so when you go into that job, most people go into it because they really want to test themselves to the limits in the most extraordinary situations, because it's incomparable to other jobs, obviously. And so if you really want to stretch yourself to the ultimate limit, then, you know, that's the natural area to work within. So most people that work in MI6 are people that actually, yes, they're very, very patriotic, obviously. They wouldn't get in if they were not. So they have to be people that firmly believe in Western values and you know, the protection of the United Kingdom and you know, the defense against the threats against it.
Your loyalty has to be unquestionable, I would assume.
It has to be unquestionable, but also the individuals that MI6 employs are individuals that do have their own thoughts on matters. They are very independent thinkers. They're not the types of people necessarily that would go into the military that will follow orders verbatim, you know, without question. They are independent lateral thinkers, but there is a bottom line, and the bottom line is obviously you have to be loyal to the organization that you work for, and that organization's place in the I think most people go into that because they find the work fascinating, and the fact that they are testing themselves as far as humanly possible.
Right. We're having a little problem with the thing here, but we heard most of what you said anyway.
Okay, all right.
You can't help that sometimes if this happens, but Will Cochrane is such an interesting guy, and like you were saying before, he's very quick. He's a quick thinker, and I think that's what makes the books, at least makes this book so interesting. I mean, he's going to think really fast, and he knows exactly what to do and how it's going to be done. And I mean, are you like that? I mean, you must have do you have a high IQ? Do you need a high IQ to be in MI6?
Yeah, yes, on both levels. But it's a high IQ, but also speed of thinking, as you quite rightly say, is crucially important, coupled with the ability to make a decision. Yeah, that is very, very important, because, as I mentioned earlier, when you're in the field, you've got to make decisions on your own, typically. And you've got to be able to assess a situation. You've got to be able to assess an individual very, very quickly. So that is crucial in the field. It's crucial to any operation.
Right. Now, did you find yourself in those 6 years at all, any time being attracted to a woman, having situations where you wanted to fall in love with somebody and couldn't? And that must be frustrating if you did.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's obviously your question is derived from the book. It's an interesting question. What I wanted to do in the book was highlight the issue that, you know, if you're in a situation where attraction, and of course attraction can come unexpected at any time, you know, how do you deal with that? And you know, what I didn't want Will Cochrane to do in Spycatcher was just jump into bed, you know, with somebody midway through an operation mission, because you know, unlike some of the movies and other spies,
like James Bond always had a girl, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, the reality is that I mean, as a professional, you wouldn't do that, and certainly not with somebody who's so key and vital to the operation. That I thought was you know, the jumping into bed with somebody, it might be titillating for the benefit of the story, but in reality, it just would not happen. So I human beings and attraction exists, and you know, if it's possible to explore that, then of course you do. So you know, when I was in MI6, any relationships that I had were typically outside of the work that I did.
And it must have been hard to have any friends.
Yeah, well, that's a very good question.
I mean, could you have a friend? I mean, you couldn't confide in them what you were doing, obviously, so your whole life had to be a mystery to them, basically.
Yeah, well, firstly, from a technical perspective, you can't disclose what you do to people, you know, even if they're lifelong friends.
And how many, I mean, back when you were doing it, how many MI6 agents were there? I mean, is there any knowledge of it? I mean, obviously you knew, but I mean, was there general knowledge how many there were and how many are there today?
On that level, I can't go into that level of detail.
Oh, really? Okay.
But there are a lot. The way it works in MI6, and I'm sure the same is true of CIA, is that you're all tasked on different concerns. So a lot of what I did was targeting rogue states, and particularly the highest echelons of rogue states. So, I mean, extremely senior people. What I did was kept top secret from the people who were operating in the rooms next door to me in headquarters, who were targeting different people. And what they did was kept secret from what I did. There is a cell-like structure of secrecy, and that's there in place, obviously, to ensure the integrity of each mission, each operation. In terms of your earlier question about the relationships, it is an interesting one. When I was there, one does feel a distance between what I did and what others did, and the normal world, if that's the right word. So the people that I actually mostly related with were either other operatives, other intelligence officers, or the assets, the foreign agents that I used to work with, the people that used to gather intelligence in the country.
So you could actually go out drinking with your other agents.
Well, it wasn't so much that, not on that social level, but more in terms of I understood them and they understood me. So you know, we wouldn't go out together. I mean, that would be operationally.
Oh, really? That isn't even allowed.
But certainly in terms of when I met them, they were putting their lives on the line for me, and you know, to some extent, I was doing the same for them. So it was an extremely close bond, and our meetings were covert. We would meet in very discreet places. It was certainly not public places. If it was a public place, it would be done in a certain way. But I related to them, and I related to the officers that I worked with. But normal people on the street, including friends and family, extremely difficult to relate to them because not through any sort of negative reason or any feeling of superiority, but more in terms of it almost felt like you were working in a different world, and that makes it very difficult to have those types of normal relationships.
Right. Now, does each agent have their own secrets, or do you share, like, the secrets you would know? Would another agent know those same secrets? Or do you all have your individual?
No. The field officer is the person in charge. So, you know, you can have 10, 20, 30, whatever, foreign agents that work with you. And none of them would know each other. So everything was ring-fenced. Everything was kept in isolation. They would each individually know what it was you wanted from them, and they would be individually tasked by the field operative against a specific target, but there was no information sharing whatsoever.
Wow, interesting. It must have been a very interesting time for you. Do you look back on it and miss it at all?
No, not from where I'm sat now, I don't. It's great writing about it,
I mean, do you tell your kids, "Ooh, Daddy was a secret agent"? I mean, are you?
Well, my kids are 7 and 8 years old, so they've got a loose understanding of what it was, but they don't really understand. I think when they become teenagers, it might be more meaningful for them then. But you know, at the moment, it's what did you used to do, Daddy? Did you carry a gun and this and the other? And so it's at that level. But I still think they think it's pretty cool, though.
Do you carry a gun today?
I have, have protection, yes, because I do need to be careful, but beyond that, I can't really comment.
Oh, really? I knew we'd get to a point where you wouldn't be able to answer a question, so it's interesting though. But tell me a little bit about the book. Now, for somebody who hasn't read it, I'd like you to describe the book in a little bit of, you know, just to get people interested. People are thinking,
sure,
what's this book really about?
Yeah, it's about an MI6 field operative called Will Cochran. Will is the service's most effective deadly operator, and he is tasked to identify and lure out a senior Iranian general whose code name is Megiddo. Megiddo, it is understood, is planning a terrorist attack against a location in the West. Will Cochran has very limited information about Megiddo and the operation that he wants to construct. And the book follows Will and subsequently a team of four CIA officers as they put together a plan to lure him out and capture him. So the book follows that mission through Europe, through Northeast America, and along the way, a lot of layers, a lot of twists and turns, a lot of action in certain areas, and certainly not everything that you read is as it seems.
Now, was that the way it was when you were in MI6? Were there a lot of twists and turns? Were there a lot of things that happened that you didn't expect? And I mean, was it the same way?
All the time. I mean, the nature of being a spy is that you're dealing with human beings, and human beings are extremely complex, obviously. You know, what happens in that world, you are always wondering, is this person telling me the truth? Is what they're saying accurate? Do they have an agenda that I'm not aware of? So you're constantly thinking, you know, is this going in the direction that I think it's going in? So, yes, full of twists and turns. And, of course, you can be caught out as well because of those issues.
Have there been writers that have really been close to what the way it really was? I mean, other than yours, obviously, is very, very detailed and going to be. But, I mean, have there been other writers that you've read that really have it down to what it was really like?
I mean, yes, I think there are a number, and not all of them have come from the secret world. Not all of them have been spies. I think the bottom line with espionage, and this is, again, is something that I wanted to emphasize in my book, is that very often you're on your own, and so what can happen when you're on your own in the field dealing with people can go in a number of different directions. If one looks at other novels, very often the tradecraft of a spy can be sometimes mistaken. It can be wrongly written. But I think the psychology, the issues that arise from dealing with people, very often are well captured in other books. I think if I, looking at the Cold War period of espionage activity, I think John le Carré, who himself was a former MI6 officer, he captured that moment very well in terms of the Cold War, which was really about a sort of slow burn tactical battle between the KGB and East German Stasi versus MI6 and the CIA.
You wonder how back in his time they didn't have cell phones, and they have cell phones today. You wonder how they got on without cell phones. You know, a simple thing like that that everybody takes for granted nowadays. I mean, they didn't have them back then. How did they manage?
Well, I mean, now we do have cell phones, but of course, in the world of spying, I mean, that helps in some ways, but of course, there are many things you can't say over the telephone,
right,
because cell phones can be intercepted.
You can't even text message.
Any communication can be intercepted unless you're using a covert communication system.
Do you have to be constantly paranoid about things? Or is that not the right word?
It's not paranoid is perhaps a sort of defense, but you have to be constantly aware that your cell phone could be intercepted, that, yes, text messaging is just the same, emails, obviously, the fact that the room, the hotel, your home, wherever, can be monitored by covert surveillance and indeed be bugged. So you have to be constantly aware of that. And if you are constantly aware of that, then it makes it so much easier because, of course, then you know how to communicate. And of course, you know, going back to your point about cell phones and all around in the 50s and 60s, Cold War era, much of the tradecraft that was used then that was used to communicate between an intelligence officer and his foreign spy, the asset that he's running, much of that tradecraft is still used today for exactly the reasons I've just mentioned, that actually increases in technology, the ability to communicate far easier, they are still vulnerable, and therefore in many ways you still have to use traditional means to communicate.
Right, exactly. It just seems like it was a lot tougher back then, but you know, you think of today when everybody's got a cell phone, everybody's talking on their phone constantly, and you think, how did we do it before? But people did do it before, and you didn't need cell phones. I'm not saying that they're not nice to have. They're certainly nice to have, but I mean, the obsession that America, and I don't know if Britain's the same way, but...
No, it's the same over here. It's exactly the same over here. Trust me, if I could get rid of my cell phone, I would do, but unfortunately it's too valuable. But yes, I do look back with nostalgia to the time that actually people couldn't get hold of you, you know, every minute of the day. It's quite a nice place to be.
Now, book one is Spycatcher. Now, you said the second one's already done. Does it have a title?
Yeah, it's got a working title of Sentinel. Book two is about Wilcock Crumb's deployed to Eastern Europe and Russia, and it's about his attempts to try to prevent war between Russia and America.
Now, has it already been published overseas? Over there?
No, it's not. My contract is for one book a year, this one, the book two, won't be published until July, August next year.
Same here. So it's about the same time here as it will be in England.
Yes. I've got an American publisher, HarperCollins, and a British publisher, Orion,
right.
And the books come out at exactly the same time, so there's no delay whatsoever.
So I'm wondering, book one and book two, was it easier to write book two than book one, or was it just as difficult?
I think it was easier in terms of the things that you learn along the way in writing your first novel were far easier to address in book two. So I think on that level it was much easier. In book one I actually wrote that in 5 weeks.
5 weeks?
Yeah, but there was an edit afterwards.
Right.
And within that edit there were things that say, look, can we sort of address this from a slightly different angle, or let's drop this, or emphasize that. And so within the edit process, there was a learning curve. I write very quickly. I mean, that's just the way that I work and the way that I like to work. And the same is true for book two. I wrote it very quickly.
Now, how are the covers different from, the United States one has an eagle on it. It's a beautiful, beautiful red and white, well, the sky white, and then the eagle,
yep,
there on it. How is the one different in England?
That's simply down to the publishers. That they, I didn't have any input on that aside from saying yes, I like it.
Well, what does the British one look like?
The British one is different. It's got a image of Will Cochrane that you see him from the back, and he's running through a snow-covered forest.
Right.
Pursuing something, and it captures the moment in the book.
Because I know the British have such beautiful, they do everything so beautifully. I mean, from, you know, the BBC and all the programs that are on that, too. I mean, I can imagine yours being a BBC program. Has anybody approached you about doing that? Or your agent?
I've got an agent. My agent is one of the top ones in the country here. He's a London-based agent, we are in discussions right now, not with the BBC, but actually with Hollywood. So, I mean, that's ongoing. I'm slightly out of the picture on that. I'm learning that as an author, when it comes to movie rights, that you're kept at arm's length.
Right. So you won't be writing the screenplay.
I don't think so. And to be honest, I think writing screenplays, I mean, that's a very different skill set. And I've been told by other authors, some very well known, that it's a difficult thing to do. But ultimately, it's best to try and keep yourself out of that process and allow those professionals to do it. But of course, as an author, you're always protective of your work, and you always hope they get it right. But ultimately, I think that if it's made into a movie, that
Right. Now, you say, how did you pronounce it? Megiddo. Megiddo.
Megiddo, yes.
But I think that, isn't that a biblical name?
It is, yeah. It's derived from Armageddon. Megiddo is a real site in Palestine, now Israel, that was the site in ancient history of a lot of battles, very bloody battles, and that's where the word Armageddon comes from. So that's hence the code name for the antagonist.
Now, book two, will that have some of the same characters in book one? Obviously, will be in it, but I mean, will it have some of the other characters in it too?
Yes, it will do. Yeah, absolutely, and new characters. So one of the characters in book one in Spycatcher is a character called Harry Solberg. He's an agent and a rather sort of dubious individual, but equally rather likable, and he crops up in book two. My intention overall is to, you mentioned earlier about having a small cast of characters, which again I think is reflective of the work that we'll have to do in the field.
Right.
But there will be characters that come in and out, and as the books progress, there'll be more and more characters. And I'm sort of painting the intelligence landscape and the number of people that are going to be working within that. So there are a lot more characters that will come out, but there will be recurring characters, and I think that's important too.
So you know who you want to put in each book. I mean, you're already working on book three.
Yeah.
Do you know down the line what book four and five are going to be about too?
Well, at the moment I know where book 10 and 11 are going, so yes. Oh my gosh, really? I know where the stories are going. And there are a lot of overlapping themes as well.
How do you keep track of everything, or is it easy with... obviously, you have a brilliant mind, or you wouldn't be a former MI6 agent.
I don't know. I wouldn't confirm or deny that. I find it very easy to deal with different layers and different plot lines and think forward and backwards. I mean, that comes very naturally to me. So that's not an issue.
And the thing is, when we read these books, I mean, when you read Spycatcher, there are points where you wonder whether Will Conquer is going to survive. I mean, is he going to survive to the next scene? You know, he's the main character in the book, but you wonder, you know, what's going to happen to him next. And there has to be that sense of danger.
Yeah, I mean, he's put into a situation. When I wrote the book, I did lay out a plot, but only sort of a page of bullet points as to, you know, the basic plot. But in terms of writing it, I would very often put him into situations and think, right, I haven't foreplanned as to how he's going to get out of the situation. So I very deliberately put him into a situation and thought, right, let's see where it goes from here.
Right.
And that makes the writing process exciting because, you know, you're there with a reader essentially thinking, right, you know, how on earth is he going to get out of this? But he's tested. But it must be the same for any recurring character. You know he's going to survive if he's going to be in, you know, a whole series of books. But nevertheless, the jeopardy is still there because you don't know how he's going to survive and at what cost. And also the people around him, you know, there are casualties,
right.
You know, who is going to die, and during the course of the books, there will be people that die that perhaps the readers didn't expect to die, and, you know, that's my intention.
Wow. So you're contracted to how many books now with Harper?
Three at the moment.
Three at the moment.
Although, you know, at the end of that, it's expected there'll be a renewal of contract. The publishers are completely behind the intention of having a whole series that really is a sort of an updated series of books that brings, you know, James Bond into where we are now. Although Will Cochrane is not James Bond, he's very different, and certainly I wrote the series without, you know, even thinking about James Bond or trying to, you know, draw comparisons, either positive or negative, to that. But certainly that's their intention, and they're completely behind that.
Right, which is great. I mean, I can hardly wait for book two. I mean, that's the worst part of being a fan. You have to wait a year for the next book. You know, once you're done the first book, it takes so long for the next book. You know, a year is a long time to wait.
It is a long time, but my intention is to produce one high quality book per year. I don't want to just churn them out. I think it's very important.
Absolutely not.
You know, the quality is there because, you know, I'd rather not, you know, produce a book if it wasn't of the high quality.
Now, is there somebody, I mean, obviously you know a lot about being an MI6 agent. Is there somebody who checks all your facts to make sure they're all right before the books come out, or do you not need that?
I don't need that, but MI6 does read my books because they obviously have to make sure that I'm not betraying any secrets.
Oh, really?
Everything that I write has to be vetted by them. Thankfully, I'm on very good terms with them, still in very close contact. And in terms of Spycatcher, they made no deletions or amendments. I mean, that was all fine. I wrote the book very much minded not to put in any secrets that would compromise them or existing operations or operatives. But in terms of the actual technicalities, the nuts and bolts of espionage, I know that. So, I mean, that's not an issue.
Do you, in your mind, feel there's a threat, a terrorist threat, because of the 10-year anniversary of 9/11? I mean, do you think... I mean, I know you can't go into detail or anything, but I'm just wondering, in your opinion, what do you think there's a threat imminent?
Well, I mean, there has always been a threat over the last 10 years. For every terrorist operation that succeeds, 1,000 are thwarted, and they are thwarted by the efforts of the likes of the CIA, the FBI, MI6, MI5.
Are they getting better every day at doing that, at thwarting these attempts?
They are getting better. I mean, they are very, very stretched. I mean, it is now more than ever the work of being an intelligence operative is probably at its most toughest.
Are you fearful?
I'm fearful not so much of is there going to be another Al-Qaeda attack, because Al-Qaeda is significantly weakened comparative to when it operated in 9/11.
Right.
That's not my major fear. My fear is more in terms of the Western intelligence services have been thrown full force by the governments of America and Britain in particular, you know, at the terrorist threat, and quite rightly, that's where they've been tasked, because they're the best units to deal with that. My concern is rather more that they are probably now extremely stretched, and they are taking their naturally. They can no longer focus as much on traditional espionage targets, meaning the major established rogue states, because those states are the ones that have the ability to cause global war through nuclear deployments or conventional war. So I think the moment we're seeing is almost a sort of paramilitary moment of the work of the likes of CIA and MI6. And that is fine, but the traditional espionage work is still absolutely vital. So I think a major terrorist operation against the West, I think that's less likely now. But of course, within that, the concern is that things that we would have combated in the past by intelligence now could potentially be more likely. And that could be, for example, related to Iran's nuclear program, general instability within the Middle East, North Korea, of course, and major established threats like Russia.
I wonder, when you were done with MI6 and you went back to your civilian life, when you were just a... What that was like, that first week or month or so afterwards. Was it hard to adjust?
It was hard. It was easy in terms of going into the outside world from an employment perspective. I think everyone who leaves MI6, typically MI6 individuals, they are very high achievers, so it's easy to get employment in the outside world. But it's very hard. I mentioned earlier the secret world. It's very hard to go outside of the organization when the secret world is still all around you, because the secret world can be the restaurants that you eat in, it can be the bar you go to, it can be the normal things, and you're constantly minded of that. But I think the transition ultimately is very difficult, because you want to integrate with normal people, you want to have normal relationships, and it's probably taken me about 10 years, I think, to get used to that, to adapt.
So when 9/11 happened, you were an agent at the time.
Yeah, I'd left a few months before, although
Oh, you had, okay.
Yeah, although I met up with a few former colleagues on the day, and we discussed it. We all knew on that day that America and Britain would go to war, even though it wasn't public knowledge. We all knew it would happen, and we were concerned about the implications of that.
I'm wondering, in book two, is there a nasty villain like there is in book one? I mean, I love that aspect of it, having that a villain each time. I mean, is there going to be somebody in book two that's going to be equally as evil or maybe even more evil?
Yeah, there is, absolutely. And I love having that sort of master evil antagonist. I think that's...
I must admit, the ending of the first book is fabulous. I mean, that to me is what makes or breaks a book, to have that really nice ending. I mean, is that difficult to come up with? Was it difficult for book two, and is it going to be difficult for book three?
No, it's not difficult. Maybe difficult in terms of delivery, but not difficult in terms of plotting it. I think that was important to me to have that major twist, because I think that can be very satisfying.
Definitely.
Yeah,
yes.
So that's important. But yes, so as you said a moment ago, having a major evil, baddie, I think that's important. It's great for drama, but also it is rooted in my background in terms of things have changed a bit in terms of what intelligence organizations do. A lot of it now is having to deal with fanatics who are trying to blow up part of the West. When I was in MI6, the people that I would be targeting were very senior individuals, very professional, typically highly educated, very sophisticated on many levels, nevertheless quite evil in terms of what they wanted to do. But those types of people are the types of people that I like to have as the baddies in the book, because I think that makes for greater drama.
I wonder, in successive books, obviously you can't give too much away about MI6. There's a lot of stuff you can't talk about. So it must be difficult writing it when you know you can't write certain things. You'd love to be able to talk about certain things and you can't. I mean, is that difficult to do? And do you have trouble with the plotting?
It's not difficult to do in terms of disclosure aspect of it, because as I say, I'm writing from the perspective of being a field operative, and so everything is up for grabs when you do that. You're in the field. You're not talking about sophisticated gadgets or classified support that might be available, because as a field operative you don't get that. You're on your own.
Right.
So within the movies and certain books, when you see the operative suddenly dial into his cell phone and suddenly he's got satellite coverage of some part of the globe, or he's linked up to somebody he wants to speak to, that isn't how it works at all. So there is a lot of latitude in terms of what I can say and talk about in the stories that actually doesn't betray any secrets, because, as I say, you're on your own. You're
right.
Making decisions on the ground. In terms of the plotting, as a result of that, it makes it very easy, because then essentially it's the field operative who's deciding, what should I do faced with this situation? Again, in terms of how I write the books, I decided, because that's my background, to write from the field operative perspective for a number of different reasons, but also because I thought, well, actually that will circumvent the sensitive issues that I would face if I was writing from the perspective of Langley headquarters or SIS, MI6 headquarters in London. So that gets around all of that.
Now, how many countries was Spycatcher published in?
At the moment, I think we're now up to, I think, about 7-8, and it's likely to... 7-8 different publishing houses. How many different countries is it published in? Ooh, probably about 30 or 40 at the moment.
Oh, wow. That's exciting.
Yeah. So
this is an exciting time for you. And then to make it more exciting, you're very talented. I mean, you're obviously very talented. This is a very excellent book, and it's a great book to take to the beach. Of course, the summertime's almost over now, but it's a great book to sit and enjoy. That's exactly what I did, to sit and enjoy it. I mean, it's... it starts out a book, you think, oh, this is just going to be standard spy stuff. And before you know it, you're just caught up in this whole story. You know, it really just grabs you and doesn't let go.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, I mean, summertime here is definitely over. I can tell you that looking out my window right now. But maybe it's extending a bit more where you are. But
so when will you finish book three?
Book three, I'll probably finish it in the next couple of weeks. And then in terms of what else I'm doing right now, you know, interviews, obviously. I'm doing quite a few sort of different articles for various newspapers. So there's a lot of marketing as well.
Will you ever do a United States tour for your books?
Yeah, I'd love to because you know, the book is doing so well in America, and it seems to have really hit the market there very well, which is great. So I'd absolutely love to go to the States. I do go to the States a reasonable amount, but obviously the States is a huge country, so doing a sort of tour is quite complex. But I would love to do that to meet the readers there.
I see that it's an e-book also, which is great too. So
yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Very, very cool. I'm very, very pleased with this, and I can't wait to read the Sentinel. And you know, it's just an exciting time for you. And I thank you for joining us. We've just about run out of time, but it's been very enjoyable to talk to you.
Well, no, it's been a pleasure, David. So thank you for having me on your show. And I think, you know, in terms of Sentinel, I think it's a different story, and I think it's even more, in some ways, even more complex. But equally, it's got a lot of action, a lot of layers to it.
You'll have to slip me a copy in the mail so I can read it. I can't wait to read it.
Absolutely. The moment I can, I promise you, I will.
Oh, really? Oh, I'm going to hold you to that promise. You know that.
Please do. You know where to find me, so that's
right.
Fine.
Right. And this is, we have to say goodbye to Matthew Donnell, but Spycatcher, again, is the book. It's published by Morrow and all your bookstores now. And this has been David's Book Talk, and we'll talk to you later.